Cha-ching. That's the sound of Lowe's Labor Day savings. Get up to 45% off select major appliances and save up to an additional $100 on select laundry pairs. Plus, get 3 bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil for just $10. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in-store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. See Lowe's.com for more details. Soil offer excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Now let's go back to the case that everybody's loving talking about and can't wait for it to end. The prosecution has rested its case in the Lindsay Clancy trial. Defense will be resting soon as well. After 14 days at Plymouth Superior Court, and some of what happened inside that courtroom has legal analysts asking whether the Plymouth County DA's office is reading the room very well. Eric Faddis is a defense attorney and former prosecutor who can help us read what's been happening.
One of the best.
There. And we'd love for your thoughts in the comments section. Let's start here. Lindsay Clancy's former mother-in-law, Susan Clancy, told the jury Lindsay was very nurturing, a very loving mother, a wonderful mother. On cross, I mean, again, this is mother-in-law. So seen in many cases where the mother does horrible things to the grandchildren, mom-in-law is usually one of the most vitriolic, bitch-should-die people in the case. This ain't that at all. Very nurturing, very loving, wonderful mother, her words. On cross, the prosecutor asked Susan if she was an active member of the Catholic Church. He said yes. And then, so you're aware that murder is considered a mortal sin. The judge struck it from the record pretty damn quick. Eric, help us understand. Was that calculated? Was that someone overstepping their bounds? Well, what do you think was going on in the minds of the ADA at that moment in time?
You know, in part, the prosecution has to prove that Lindsay Clancy knew right from wrong, among a lot of other elements they have to prove.
Yeah.
And I think this question was sort of calculated to maybe touch on that, but it doesn't make sense because it's Lindsay Clancy's mental state that is material. It's not the mother-in-law, whether the mother-in-law thinks it's some kind of mortal sin. And in fact, when you inject the religious judgment piece to this, I think it's prosecutorial misconduct. I think you're running the risk of trying to, you know, scare these jurors, perhaps some jurors who might be religiously oriented,
yeah,
and say, oh, you know, this is a mortal sin. You better punish her for that. I think it is totally improper. The judge made the right call.
What really, there's so many striking things in this case. And, you know, as this recording, I was just watching before we started Dr. Resnick's testimony, who is the expert on postpartum psychosis, if in the country, if not the world, really doing an amazing job explaining what the and really dismantling what the prosecution's accusing. We'll see what happens when the jury gets it. What I'm really curious about this, Eric, because this is a very unique case on so many fronts, but one of the behavior sides that I have found very unique, and I'm curious what your thoughts are on how that hits home to, since we're talking about the prosecutors, the two in there. When you have an entire room, now I'm not the entire room because I know they have their own witnesses coming in there, but when the courtroom is filled with family, friends, colleagues, people who lived and experienced Lindsay throughout their life, going back 15, 20, and her 30 plus years of life, all standing with her on the defense side, and you're the two prosecutors in there, and you come across in these moments being very tone deaf. How does that resonating with them? What do you think they're feeling? How do you think they're able to, is it affecting them as prosecutors, you think? I mean, it's a very unique situation that, because I was even thinking about this, you know, when it comes to if she's convicted, if they find her guilty and they give victim impact statements, who? I mean, because right. they're all standing yeah. with Lindsay. So, I mean, it's a very unique situation. How does that resonate as a prosecutor to them, do you think?
I think as a prosecutor, you're like, whoa, I'm outnumbered. And I think you're also like, well, I thought going in this case was pretty strong and people would agree with me that Lindsay was in the wrong. But gosh, look at these rows and rows of human beings who have known Lindsay her entire life, who are sticking by her. And not only the effect on the prosecutor, Robin, the effect on the jury. The jury is watching who is in that courtroom, where they're sitting, whom they're sitting behind, whom they seem to be supporting. And that could go a long way. Even though it's not technically evidence the jury's allowed to consider, you better believe they're going to say, hey, they've got dozens of people here behind this person. If she was such a monster that the prosecution was making her out to be, these folks wouldn't be here.
I got another question for the courtroom conduct and how and what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do in these situations and what you think the jury is picking up on. So I've done my best. I've watched most of it live. And if not, I saw it on playback. And because it is literally one of the most fascinating things I've ever watched in my life, because it's like watching a Netflix special, because it's so, it sucks you in because it's so important. The stakes are so high and the content is so impactful on our society, really, because we're talking about women's mental health. And when her fellow colleague, one of the nurses that she worked with in labor delivery, she'd known, I think, Lindsay, and I apologize to everyone that listens in. I'm always off a little bit on my stats, and so I might be off, but about 15 years she knew her. And I watched her when she come off the witness stand after she's interviewed by Reddington, the prosecutors, and then a little bit of redirect. And so as she's coming off, she made a slight little head nod to Lindsay, I caught it. And I was like, wow, even after all this, this woman is still letting her know, because she even said, I'm still friends with her today. And she gave her that little glance. So my question is she allowed to do that? And either way, do you think that's something that resonates well with the jury or not?
Typically, you are not supposed to engage in gestures or facial expressions or something like that that is not evidence, but that the jury might see that could influence them. And so a lot of times you see like attorneys or defendants or the prosecutors asking a question, they're rolling their eyes. They say, oh my God, how could they even be suggesting this? And the judge will say, hey, you cannot be making those facial expressions, those gestures. They might affect the jury in an improper way. So it's probably improper, but those things happen all the time. And you better believe some of the jurors picked up on them.
It was a micro. I mean, I'm talking, you know, micro expressions happen in like an eighth or a 16th of a second. And it was a micro, but I saw it and I was like, huh, wow, she's still connected. Anyway, thanks.
I want to go back to the mortal sin. because
that was something, wasn't it?
It is. I mean, and being as improper as it might have been, I agree with Eric. I don't know that it was necessarily for the mother. You know, I mean, she had to direct it at somebody. So she directed it towards the mother. But in doing so, it is throwing it into the ether to anyone who I guess would be religious would be, is that a mortal sin? Oh my! And then you're going to have to question that yourself, whether the question is directed at you or not. So every single juror sitting there is going to be facing that question, you know, depending on their belief system. Mm-hmm. And I know Reddington, you know, said disregard. And there's moments in trials all the time where it's disregard this, disregard that. But sometimes those disregards end up becoming appellate issues. If she is convicted on this, let's say she is convicted on this. How big of a nugget is that if they needed to go and appeal this to a higher court, the fact that she brought that level of religious vitriol into this? Have you ever seen that before in other cases where religiosity gets injected in some way, shape, or form, and it's used as a lever on appeals?
Oh, sure. You know, those things can pop up. And sometimes it varies by jurisdiction. Sometimes, if you have a more rural, perhaps conservative, perhaps traditional type of jurisdiction, you might see more references to God and references to religion than you mm-hmm. would, you know, in a downtown Denver case or something.
Yeah.
So, but yes, I think that it is very ripe for an appellate ground if there is a conviction.
Yeah.
Because you, Tony, cannot play upon the jury's sympathies or prejudices in order to try to convict a person. And when you are going to perhaps the heart of their identity, they might be a very religious person.
Yeah.
And they might now be thinking, hey, can I really let a person go on a mortal sin? Can I live with that in my conscience? No, I better convict him. Well, you've got appellate issues galore.
Is religion one of the questions on the questionnaire, you think, for the jury questionnaire?
It can be. There's been a push away from that. So you usually now you don't ask like political affiliation, religious affiliation. But if there's something that's relevant to the case in terms of religiousness, that can be inquired into. So, yeah, those things they're less expressly referenced in jury selection now, but you can still inquire.
And which begs my thought and question, like we've been saying, was that question necessarily geared for the mother-in-law of Lindsay, or was it really geared for impact on the jury? And if it was geared for the impact on the jury, knowing, I mean, hell, I just listened to you and Bob Mata, you know, talk about this stuff, and I'm saying that was like a dumb move because of the appellate process. He raised the objection, which means they can bring it up. Do you think that was a good strategic move? Because these prosecutors, I looked them up. I think one of them has like 15 years, you know, sitting as a prosecutor for the state. I think, again, don't quote me, everyone. I don't have my nose right in front of me, but she's got some experience. Is that a rookie move, or do you think it was strategic?
I think it was a move of desperation. I think a lot of people have feelings about the direction this trial's going, and the prosecutors included in that, and I think it was a desperate move. Hmm.
Good point.
Back to mortal sin.
Sorry, I shouldn't be laughing.
If a juror, let's say she gets convicted here, and then let's say they're doing an interview on Dateline or somebody's show. And why did you convict her? Well, because it was a mortal sin. And that's their answer. And I know we weren't supposed to take that into consideration, and I didn't. But I myself reflected on that and realized that is a mortal sin, and I have to convict based on that being a mortal sin. Is that Becky Hill all over again to a certain extent? I mean, it's a different type of dynamic, and who's saying it? But does that... I mean, once a verdict is rendered and if a juror were then to tell, here's how I came to my conclusion, and they came to that conclusion through a path that the judge flat out said, disregard, but they went there anyway, and they're saying, well, it didn't have anything to do with them saying it, but it's my own convictions, regardless if it was said out loud or not. Where does that go?
What you're touching on is something appellate courts are always looking at when they're deciding whether to overturn a conviction, and that's the effect on the juror. There can be a lot of problematic stuff that goes on in a trial. No one is entitled constitutionally to a perfect trial. You're just entitled to a trial devoid of constitutional errors. And so, and even if some of those errors happen, the impact, if they didn't impact the overall determination, oftentimes that's not going to result in reversal. And so if there is impact on some juror because of that statement, I think that you are looking at a get out of jail free card. You are looking at an automatic new trial.
Yeah. And think about this. It doesn't even have to be that one person that said it. I mean, so how granular does it need to be, and how subjective can it be? So say you're one of the people on the jury, and you know, because of you're sitting in the jury room together, you're conversing a lot throughout this, getting to know each other very well throughout this process, and you hear that one of your fellow jurors is a really hardcore devout Catholic, and at some point you overheard them talking about sins and everything. Could they then, through supposition or interpretation of what that actually means, say that they think they're probably swayed, and then present that, in other words, hearsay and conjecture presented out from someone else of what they think they might have done? Is that enough or no?
It very well may be. Look, at the appellate level, you do not have to prove it's 100% that this improper statement was the primary reason a juror did what they did. Your burden is lower than that. It depends on the jurisdiction, but you kind of just have to establish, you know, significant likelihood that there was such an effect. And you would use things like that, Robin. You would say, hey, these jurors heard them talking about sins and stuff. Well, a sin, that's not a basis to render a conviction. And if there is a compelling presentation that it did influence that determination, then you don't necessarily need the juror to say that expressly.
Yeah, because I can imagine in a – so let they're not privy to everything that's going on in social media right now and how divided the world is on this case right now. And maybe not. I've got my fingers crossed after Dr. Resnick's presentation today. If you have critical thinkers that are still remaining on either side, it was helping that out. But it, because it's so divisive, I can only imagine that the, potentially the jury is that divisive as well. And this is why a lot of us are thinking, you know, the probability of a hung jury is pretty high on this one, because getting a unanimous thought together on this because of the issue involved, because of the murder of the children, and also because of the mental health issue, it's very compelling on both sides. It's hard in a world to imagine it not happening, where you have one of the jurists that wanted to acquit because of insanity. I know it's not the exact, you know, thing, wordage in Massachusetts, but then coming out saying, I can overturn this because I heard this. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I think cases are so commonly overturned based on what is labeled juror misconduct, but sometimes right. it's the jurors doing something they're not supposed to do because of somebody else's misconduct. And so that is a prime ground for reversing convictions, almost always looked at by every appellate counsel that I know.
She really screwed herself, that prosecutor, didn't she?
There's a lot here where you look at where was she? We've talked about this the other week. Like, were you really trying to win this, or you know, was this the kind of cards you were dealt and you put a bow in your hair and went to work and did the best you could? I mean, the prosecution opened this trial by telling the jury Lindsay was controlling, meticulous, and manipulative. And then proceeded to parade a bunch of people in front of the jury that said she was loving, she was detailed, and she was kind. And it's like, well, we don't really have any evidence of this controlling, meticulous, manipulative person here, other than the moment that she seemed to have snapped and went into this psychosis and wasn't herself at all anymore. She's paralyzed from the waist down. She cut her wrists and neck before jumping out a window. And they said that, well, you know, these are superficial. She can't walk anymore. She has no movement from her neck down in so many ways. I mean, it's like the prosecution set the bar up here, knowing full well they're going to drive into an arena where the bar is going to be way down here and everybody's going to see it's down here. That makes me not want to trust anything they're saying when, well, this is what this is, everybody, and here's what it actually is. Even if it's not, you know, it's still icky. It's still, you know, she killed her kids, but it's not what you said it was. So I don't know that I fully trust that prosecutor. I mean, how does that land in a jury when they set the bar so damn high with accusations that just are not going to be proven because they're just not accurate about someone's personality? How does a jury take that at the end of the day?
You know, the jury trial process at its best is a truth-finding process. And you can, before the trial, as a prosecutor, have a great case on paper. You think it's a great case. And then you're getting really into it. And you're like, oh, she was manipulative here. She was controlling. And I can tell the jury all these things. They're gonna side with me. But if you overplay your hand, for example, if you bring too many charges, if you're really like piling on in a way that seems unfair and unjust, the jury's going to pick up on that. Likewise, if you're trying to sell them some BS from the outset, and then they hear from witnesses and see evidence that contradicts the narrative the prosecutor is trying to sell these folks, they're going to be insulted. They're going to be offended. They're going to say, hey, you're insulting my intelligence and you're trying to pull the wool over my eyes. I thought you guys were the good guys, prosecutors. And then it can just soil everything in the remainder of the trial.
I'm going to use Tony's words. Going back to the mortal sin.
Yeah.
So here she is. Let's assume the prosecutor's got a decent level of self-awareness. She's smart. She's educated. She reflects and she goes, uh-oh, I really hosed myself and I hosed myself with the jury. She's got reps in front of juries like this before. What can she do, if anything, to negate that negative confirmation bias she just gave the jury about her?
What would bow. That's bigger bow. Yeah. Bigger bow the next day. That's how you do that.
You know, I think part of one big piece that I play upon in jury trials is vulnerability. And when there are issues or mistakes, I think it's on the balance best to own them and to say, you know, hey, we're hearing some of these people testify from the for the first time too, just like you are. And you know, what we need to base your determination on is what happened during this trial, not what we thought might happen or what somebody else thought might happen. But here is the reality of it. Here are the facts. And so I think trying to be a bit vulnerable in those circumstances can really go a long way with the jury.
At what point can she do that? Because, you know, it's always, you know, when you're looking at the prosecutor up there, that they were just the facts, ma'am. You know, here's our witness. Here's my questions. Here's the line. She doesn't give a whole lot of narrative beforehand. So how can you insert that vulnerability throughout the course, or do you have to wait till closing arguments to do it?
You might have to wait till closing arguments, and that's a point where you can look these jurors in the eyes, and you know, prosecutors are not unfamiliar with a witness going sideways, with a witness saying something that we didn't think they would say. You got to adapt to that. You got to be ready for that. And part of that is not overplaying your hand, because you don't know exactly what it's going to look like during that gauntlet of a jury trial.
Do you think it's best for her to ignore it in closing arguments, or should she address it?
I think it makes sense to address it in sort of a glancing, sensitive sort of fashion.
Nice. Thanks. I know I've been hammering you on it. Thanks.
One more on this segment before we move out of the kind of the critique of the prosecution of Lindsay. Let me ask you this. Obviously, there's a lot of seeming from the prosecution, throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks here. I don't feel like there's been a real clear, here's why I should believe that she had a clear mind and it was just another Tuesday to Lindsay Clancy when she decides to put exercise bands around her kids, slit her wrists and her neck, and jump out a second story window. Doesn't seem like somebody is operating in their right mind. That all being said, there's a gazillion theories online. There's a gazillion rage directions that people are taking this, some based on facts, some based on misinterpretations of facts, some based on utter delusion. The jury obviously not supposed to be looking at social media, not supposed to be going online. Be honest with me. How often do jurors actually, because it's the honor system, Eric, unless they're sequestered, it's the honor system. Nobody has a check on their devices to go, well, I see you were on Facebook last. It's just the honor system that we're operating with here. How honorable are jurors typically that they're not consuming other perspectives on cases? Quite just your gut.
My apprehension is that we have these instructions to jurors that say you can't do this, you can't do that. And there is actually a legal presumption that the jurors followed them absent some contradicting evidence. So we presume that they're going to follow them. But is that presumption really sound? Is that really reliable? You know, you think that person's not going home to their partner in 30 years? And the partner says, what's going on? And they're like, well, I'm a juror in a trial. Well, what's it about? I think some of them are going to say, hey, I can't talk about it. But you better believe, just statistically, a minority of them are going to talk about it. And they might even come into contact with coverage about it, perhaps innocently, perhaps unintentionally. And that still can be a problem.
One more question, Eric, is again, I was watching, and Gen Z, yeah, we've been going back and forth, and yeah, for everyone to get a chance today, watch Dr. Resnick's testimony today. It was really, really compelling, explained an awful lot science-wise, psychosis-wise. But a few things, and so this is my question to you, Eric. So a few times throughout his testimony, he made reference to what the jury's already heard from these other experts and a few of things like that. What are people that are testifying allowed to watch or see prior to them testifying? So in other words, I was very curious, did he just say something off that he shouldn't have seen, like he shouldn't have seen something in the case? Or, I mean, how's that work?
Yeah, really good question. So the general rule, Robin, is for a witness, there are what's called a sequestration order. It's similar to the concept of sequestering a jury, whereby that witness cannot be privy to or receive any information about what has happened in the trial before. So they can't hear the testimony of witness one if they're witness two. The exception to that, however, is experts. Experts can receive information about the case, including about what other witnesses have testified testified to, because those experts can opine on, you know, hey, this witness said that this happened, but in my expert opinion, that's impossible. Or this other expert said that X was the condition, but in my opinion, I think this other expert's wrong for these reasons. So an expert can opine and receive information about what else has gone on in the trial, whereas normal witnesses typically cannot.
Thanks. That's a big help, because I remember, so I watched a testimony where they're interviewing and doing cross on the TikToker, and she was dismissed. And when she was even told, when Reddington contacted her, he sequestered her. So she had to stop watching everything. And then all of a sudden I saw Dr. Resnick up there saying things like he saw. And I was like, oh, where's his line? So thanks for that, Eric. Appreciate it.
Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down the Lindsey Clancy case. The links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
If this jury finds Lindsey Clancy not criminally responsible, she does not walk free. Contrary to popular belief, she's not going to be like, where are you going next? Disneyland. That's not what's going to happen. Massachusetts law sends her basically back where she's been, psychiatric facility for observation and long-term commitment. She's already been at Tewksbury State Hospital for more than 3 years. The question isn't whether she'd be released. It's what happens next inside that system. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is with us, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. So under Massachusetts law, the court can order a 40-day observation period after an insanity verdict, and the DA can petition for 6 months, then another 6 months. Andrea Yates was found not guilty by reason of insanity in 2006, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. She's still in a state facility 20 years later. Is commitment a shorter road or a longer one here, Siobhan? And how would this play out? Is it constantly a renewal every 6 months on the part of the state? Or explain to the audience what would happen here.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because this was one of my jobs in my forensic history, where I was one of the people that went in every 6 months to do evaluations. How is this person doing in the facility? What kind of progress are they making? Are they deteriorating? Are they taking medication? Are they still symptomatic? Are they aggressive? I mean, it was a really comprehensive evaluation. And I worked for the state of California, and we had a team in our county, and it went county by county. So everybody that was in an institution like this who had committed a crime, it was a locked facility, and from what I hear about Tewksbury, the prisons, or I call them the forensic prisons, right? It was for the mentally ill folks who had committed crimes. Not a terribly pleasant place, not what we think of as a private mental health facility at all. Quite prison-like in many ways, but there was more treatment going on than you would get in a prison. But that was one of the things. When we had people that were released, they went into our program, the conditional release program, where they were very closely monitored. There was a team of therapists. We each had no more than 7 people that we closely monitored. We had daily contact with some, depending on how they were doing. Otherwise, it was, you know, weekly individual therapy, weekly group therapy, sometimes 2 groups a week. They were drug tested. We went out and did surprise home inspections. I mean, it was really closely monitored to make sure that they were safe in the community, because the number one criteria for being out after you've been in a situation like this is safety of the community. Now, some of those people had been in that program for 20 and 30 years, where they were living in the community, but we were monitoring them. But the other piece of that job, I was the person, and I wasn't the only one, it was everyone on the team that had a group that we followed that were still in the institution. And we would go in every 6 months, that was the law, and we would do a full evaluation of how they were doing in the institution. And we would go through every record, we would have an interview with them. If they had had recent psych testing, we would go over the results of that. And then we could make a recommendation to the court, this person is doing so well. They're no longer symptomatic. They have insight into their condition. And we would write all that up, document it. It was copious records that we kept. And then it went back to the team. And it was, yeah, this person is looking terrific. They've made so much progress. We believe they could, you know, go into the conditional release program. And they would have a shot at life outside. Now, that could be 10 years later. It could be 20 years later. Or it could be never. And there were many, many people who were never going to be well enough to get out. So it could, in essence, be a life sentence. And very seldom, in fact, I can't think of one that I went in and interviewed and recommended that this person should be looked at closer for possible release. So it's rare. It's rare to get out. And it does happen. Some people make tremendous progress and do have a recommendation to get out, but it's not common.
And so some great points there, Siobhan, and I apologize for my mic falling a second ago, everyone. So as I understand it from you, so you're the psych team inside the prison at the mental health prison, they make their recommendations to the court, but still it's ultimately the judge and the court that decide whether they're released or not. Then based upon, I'm guessing, the totality of what actually that crime was. In other words, if you had the judge, and you, even if you and your team make that recommendation that we think she's fit to reenter society, the judge could still say, yes. Nope, no. Killed three kids, never.
Yeah. Never. Yeah. Or we're going to reevaluate every 6 months for the rest of their stay. Right. It's going to be an every 6 month evaluation. Right. And I didn't actually work in the facility. I worked outside of the facility, but I would go into the different state hospitals across the state every 6 months and go over all the staff records, any testing that had been done, their behavior, and they had treatment goals in the facility. How were they doing with their treatment goals? I knew, just to toss out an example, one guy was never going to get out. His treatment plan in the facility, he was so low functioning, was he will stop drinking out of the toilet and stop stabbing the other inmates in the lunch line with pencils. And okay, this guy was never going to get out. You know, this is not a person who's going to improve. And there were a lot of folks like that. So it, people who had committed certain kinds of horrendous sex offenders, they were not going to get out because they were just never going to be considered safe to be in the community.
Let me throw some of the things your way that I know some of the audience is thinking, and you can answer it. What if she fakes her way out? What if she finds a way to fool all the doctors, Siobhan?
I personally have not seen that happen. And again, we get into, is this a psychotic person or is this a psychopathic person?
Yeah.
And when we look at people who do that, who in prison go before the parole board and come up with this elaborate story about how they've changed and progressed, that's psychopathic. And when you're dealing with folks with severe mental illness, it just doesn't really go that way. So I'm very skeptical of that happening.
Does she have a choice? I mean, Andrea Yates is still in a facility. And I know I have read that she doesn't want to leave. I don't know the predicate before that of how that all functions. So I'm asking you, is it up to her? Is it up to Lindsay? I mean, if she is deemed okay to release into society outside of the facility, who ultimately makes that call? And if the facility says, you're good to go, but she's like, I'm happy here.
Yeah.
Does she have a say?
Excellent. Excellent question. And the only people who would be considered good to go would be people who are eager to go and have a very clear life plan. How am I going to make sure that I stay on my medication? How am I going to make sure that I don't have a relapse with my condition? What would be the signs of having a relapse? How would I have support? So it has to be people who are doing really well and really motivated to get out. And if they didn't want to get out, if they felt safer in the institution, that would be a person that would stay there.
Yeah, and Tony, straight on right. I didn't realize that. I knew she's still behind bars in the mental institutes, but yeah, Andrea Yates consistently has chosen to stay review after review after review. Yeah.
So this could be a situation where, as with Lindsay Clancy, she tried to get into some help into the facility, and then they're like, "We don't qualify." Here, she could stay if she wanted to, mm-hmm. because all she had to do was kill her kids first to finally get the help that she needs. I mean, it's horrible. I mean, it's insane. But this is how we work. Once you do something really horrible, then we'll take you seriously. Yeah. Yeah. What does it look like? Because I know everybody's thinking about all these possibilities. Here, run me down this scenario. Riddle me this. She's in the institution for a while, 5, 10 years, whatever, a period of time. She is released. She gets out into society. And everyone's fear, you know, that everyone's throwing out there online is, what if she has another baby? What if she bamboozles someone and they run off together and then she has, does, so let's just run through that. What if she does? What if she does go have a baby? What if she gets out and there's some relapsing or unhealthy behavior? Not necessarily criminal, not necessarily killing people, but just you're off your meds and we can tell you're not doing well. What sort of levers does the mental health apparatus have to go back and say, yeah, we got to bring you back here? Yeah, if anything, if no crimes have been committed.
Yeah, no, this is one of the things about monitoring folks outpatient if they were deemed safe to be outpatient. There's something called the terms and conditions of release. So it's conditional release. You're mm-hmm. only released as long as you follow to the very strict rule, the terms and conditions. For people that have a drug history, they're tested weekly or randomly tested for drugs. And if they have let's say they test dirty for THC, immediately back. And we had the right as clinicians to make an immediate call to the police and say, immediately come pick this up and put them back in the hospital. And I would think a term and condition for her would be you don't get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And if you got pregnant, you would probably immediately go back in the hospital and the child would be placed somewhere. I think that would be, you know, that would be watched very closely.
Is that indefinite? Like forever?
So it's a case-by-case basis. You know, has somebody, let's say somebody committed a fairly minor crime, because some of the folks had committed minor crimes, but they mm-hmm. did it when they were mentally ill. Like one guy was schizophrenic, and he decided one day to hijack the city bus around town, and he pulled out a butter knife and waved a butter knife around. That got him in the state hospital. He was eventually determined to have insight. He was on medication. You know, the crime had not hurt anybody. I mean, it was almost a rather silly kind of crime, but it was taken seriously. And he followed terms and conditions. But if there was anything at all that indicated he was not taking his meds, he was threatening anybody, he had paranoid thinking, anything like that, he would immediately go back in. So my guess is her terms and conditions would be very strict. And she would be monitored, possibly monitored for the rest of her life.
Here's an interesting stat on that, too. As we brought up the possibility of her getting out and giving birth again, remember, we have this little thing called menopause. And given her current age,
not there yet.
Well, she's got about, and so if you're looking roughly, it's 15 years based on average age and anywhere between 9 and 19 years. If she's in cars already beyond that, it wouldn't be an issue anyway.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But a lot of people's
I look up everything.
No, I mean, I get it. I mean, yeah, there's that, but she's not there yet. I mean, there's very real possibility that, you know, that could take place. Three defense experts diagnosed Lindsay with bipolar disorder, Tewksbury State Hospital, where she's been held for 3 years under one-to-one supervision, diagnosed her with bipolar. The prosecution's own expert, Kirk Hellburn, took the stand and agreed bipolar type 2. The only person in the entire trial who disagreed was Avram Mack, who called it major depressive disorder. Mm-hmm. Hellburn was supposed to be there to help the prosecution. Instead, he's confirmed the defense's diagnosis and handed them the argument that this was altruistic filicide, that she killed them out of love. That's the prosecution's own witness saying that, which to me sounds like a qualifying event to be found not guilty by reason of insanity.
It actually is.
She's currently on Zyprexa, which is an antipsychotic. I know all this because Siobhan corrected one of my questions when I sent it to her yesterday.
We've got such education on all this.
Yes. Great. So when the prosecution's own expert agrees with the defense on the diagnosis, what's the jury supposed to do with that?
Yeah. And we actually had more. We had, I made the list, right?
Yeah.
Dr. Donald Condi went over all the records going back from the beginning of her treatment. Serious possibility that has to be considered was bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
Paul Zeisel, bipolar disorder with postpartum psychosis. Now, this is an interesting one. Dr. Margaret Spinelli, who is considered one of the world's best forensic reproductive psychiatrists. And she evaluated her, but ultimately did not testify. And we do not know, we've not been told why she didn't testify. But her diagnosis, bipolar 1 disorder with postpartum psychosis, the jury will have access to that report. Philip Resnick, bipolar 2 disorder, severe depressive episode with postpartum psychosis at the time of the killing. Dr. Kirk Heilbrum for the prosecution, bipolar disorder, but rejected psychosis at the time of the killing. And then, of course, I think probably the worst witness was Dr. Mack, who went with major depressive disorder. But the other thing about that, you know, didn't come out at trial that I think is very relevant, you can have in severe major depressive disorder psychotic features. And that does not rule out that even if you went with just his diagnosis, which nobody else agreed with, she could have been psychotic from that.
So it all could happen under any of them.
And the SI ideation from the massive depression and then the filicide, altruistic filicide, whether it's that as presented by one of the clinicians for the prosecution in there, or the other very similar diagnosis of the psychotic break all these terms, the psychotic break basically as the explanation as well. So both are qualifying for guilty by reason of insanity. So either or, and that's what they're all agreeing on, which is you made some great points, Siobhan.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the issue?
Exactly. Like, why are we here? This just this could have been all handled. She said early on, you know, lock me away forever. And they were like, nope, we want to do this dog and pony show first. Let me ask you one quick question on this before we start talking more about all the Patrick stuff. Is there ever situations, and maybe this is a state by state thing, where someone, you know, is found guilty, goes to the prison system, and the prison system goes, this person needs a mental health hospital. They should not be in this. There's nothing we can do here that is going to keep, like, it's a liability to us. Not that they really care all that much, because people die all the times in prison. Mm-hmm. But do they make that call sometimes going, this is a mental hospital person, not a prison?
Okay. Very much that they can't be managed in prison, because prisons do employ psychiatrists.
Yeah.
Now, they don't do the kind of treatment that you would get in a place like Tewksbury, but they do monitor folks. And yes, they can make a recommendation that we need to have a hearing and get this person over into a forensic mental health facility because they're, you know, it's just not appropriate in prison. So that does happen. And the one thing that I wanted to just say a little bit about, because I think the general public is very confused. We heard a lot of references to the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And it's commonly referred to, which is completely inaccurate, as the Bible of mental health professionals. It is not the Bible. It's an evolving classification system based upon the best available evidence at the time and the clinical consistency at the time. But symptoms overlap. A lot of it is fuzzy. It is constantly changing. We get revisions every few years because teams and committees go in and take a section. They review, okay, what's the current literature? There's been new studies done. We look at it a bit differently now. And so it's changing. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, the DSM is published by the American Psychiatric Association. The rest of the world doesn't use it. Mm-hmm. They use, it's called the ICD, we're on the 11th version of that, and that's put out by the World Health Organization, and it organizes all diseases, including mental health conditions. And again, we're sort of like, we're still refusing to use the metric system here, right? We're just not.
We do it better, right?
Yeah. And so a lot of people are saying the ICD-9. And so questions during the testimony came up about that. And I don't know that was very well explained.
Yeah, that's why Reddington's been really hammering on that as well, I thought, every time he's been cross on.
He knows. He has been very educated on this stuff. Well, and I just want people to really know that the DSM is fuzzy. And if you get a room of six clinicians and they're looking at a complex case like this one, and they're trying to come up through the DSM, well, which category fits best? There's a lot of overlapping symptoms between the categories, and you may get six different opinions, and then everybody argues about it until they can come up with a consensus. So diagnosis is complicated, but it's so important that it be done well, because treatment plan is dependent on diagnosis. And we can see early on, when she was diagnosed with just generalized anxiety disorder, the treatment plan was inadequate. And it did not serve her, which is ultimately how we got into this mess.
And we're seeing in this, I think it's a segue for me to introduce this a little bit as well. You know, when my team was operating, the things we did was very similar to this. And that is, I had a specific function that I was doing for a case in operation. And we need to assess a human being, what was going on in their lives, and how we were going to have a healthy interaction with them, whatever our objective was. What my team would do is we'd have people like me, which are the behavioral analysts and experts on human behavior at the practical field level, like interacting with human beings. We would come up with our observations, our points to consider, and the things that I've been talking about here with these life arcs. And then I'd have an operational psychologist with us. We'd have either Dr. Reed Malloy, we'd have Dr. Chris Mahandy, and as we just saw on the stand, Dr. Greg Satoff was also one of the people on my team. And each one of these clinicians had specific skill sets for specific things. And I knew what each one of these specific skill sets were. And I would hand pick the ones I need, not for confirmation bias, but because they had a specific skill set with a specific tool, technique, or human being that they're interacting with. Like, I've had multiple cases where I needed a hardcore clinician that could manage some people that are actually, we knew, were kind of falling off the rails from the behavioral observation. So I brought in Dr. Reed Malloy. Mm-hmm. Hands down, a great guy for that. And then when it came to operational specifics, like we were doing some high tempo operations and people are going to be under a lot of stress, they've been through a lot of stress, I brought in my operational guy, which was Dr. Chris Mahandy. I mean, so I had these people. And then when I needed a psychiatrist with medical expertise, who had actually dealt with medications, things like that, I had Greg Satoff. So all these people fit a specific role that was very specific. And what we're seeing in this case, as presented by the prosecution, is it looks like they're throwing a shotgun at it. Let's try this. Mm-hmm. Let's try this. And that's why we're seeing all over the board.
So why on earth did we end up with Greg Satoff on the stand? I mean, I guess that's my question, because he's an expert in certain areas without a doubt. I'm not trying to discredit or play him down at all, but it feels like, this is my conjecture, the prosecution has brought a lot of people as experts in certain areas, just not this one.
Yes.
And are trying to like present them as an expert in this area because they're experts over here. So it must kind of bleed over here a little bit, right? Is that because there's just not a lot of true experts on postpartum psychosis because 100%. It is so rare?
Yeah.
Tell me about that, Siobhan.
Yeah, 100%, because it is rare. Many people have never seen it. There's not, you know, copious amounts of data on it. And I was really struck by the prosecution expert witnesses who had seen it themselves, who mm-hmm. didn't understand it themselves. And I thought Reddington did a great job of pointing out their deficiencies in really understanding it.
Yeah, it became very predictable, like when we were texting back and forth with when Dr. Greg Satoff took the stand. And I'll tell you, he has been a clinician a very long time.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen him in many years, and he was phenomenal on our team. Amazing, very well spoken, very well researched. But I was surprised to see him there in that kind of thing. So because based on my, again, I didn't know his full background when working with him. I just knew it related to us. But I could predict what Reddington was going to do based on what I knew of that and exactly what's happening today, which has happened. It's not just him. It's all of them that actually don't have that expertise, which as Siobhan just pointed out, it's a very, very rare and specific expertise. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. It is. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down the Lindsey Clancy trial.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.